Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, and we're recording on Thursday morning. We are in the middle of Gay Pride Month, and I had an interesting quote by Emile Zola. We are like books. Most people only see our cover. The minority read only the introduction. Many people believe the critics. Few will know our content. So I got to touch on two things. One, we are recording on Thursday morning, as you know, for Friday. And just as we come on the air, we find out that Pat Robertson has died at the age of 93. And Pat Robertson, evangelical Christian, did some very, very corrosive things in politics, really sort of helped to establish the takeover of the Republican Party by the Christian right. And in 1988, everyone, I just thought I would let you know, he actually even ran for president. Now, remember who was president at the time? Ronald Reagan. But he wasn't conservative enough for him, so he decided to run for president. I was thinking about 1988, and I realized that I actually almost touched Pat Robertson. Now, why do I say that? I wrote, in 1988, Orford resident, the conservative reactionary governor, Mel Thompson, hosted a presidential meet and greet for Pat Robertson. Days later, Arnie Arneson hosted a meet and greet for Congressman Dick Gephardt. Orford, New Hampshire has a population of 1,200. You gotta love the history of the New Hampshire First in the Nation presidential primary. I mean, think about it. Pat Robertson and Gephardt, literally within 24 hours of each other in this town, like the size of a, I don't know what, you know, it's a thimble. So I used to refer to it as dueling primaries. And it literally, this was the epicenter of where it happened. And yeah, Dick Gephardt and Pat Robertson within literally 24 or 48 hours of each other. I couldn't stop laughing. And then before I introduce our first guest, he is Scott Braddock's boss, Harvey Kronberg, who is the publisher of the Quorum Report. Harvey, I was listening to Morning Joe this morning, and people were talking about how frustrated and disgusted they were in the fact that Republicans are not able to stand up to Donald Trump. We know he's a liar. We know he's a thief. We know he's going to be indicted again. We know he's a sexual predator. I mean, there's just so much about him, and none of it is good. Okay, none of it is good. And yet, and then we know about January 6th, you know, be there, it'll be wild. The whole thing is he tries to overthrow an election, he tries to overthrow the government. The person with maybe something close to a spine was Mike Pence on the day of January 6th, but that was about as close as we get. And then you see Chris Christie suddenly emerging on the scene, but this is the same Chris Christie, you know, who helped, you know, prep Donald Trump for his debates against Joe Biden, who, you know, helped move the transition, really wanted to be his chief of staff, you know, and all of a sudden now he's got this come to Jesus moment, and he is like the attack dog against Donald Trump, but the only one who's actually really doing it. And then he's sort of questioned anyway about why he would do it, and would he actually vote for Donald Trump if Donald Trump becomes the nominee. So as I was listening to people saying, why don't people know how to do the right thing? Why can't they? Why does politics seem to dissolve spines? It sort of takes away your sense of integrity, gives you this sort of integrity lobotomy. And I have tell this story all the time, Harvey, and you will love it. So it's probably back in the 1980s. And a friend of ours, their son is getting bar mitzvahed. And there wasn't even a synagogue in Hanover, New Hampshire. So we went to Rollins Chapel at Dartmouth College for the bar mitzvah. And we're sitting in with the congregation, and at the end of the bar mitzvah, the rabbi turns to the young 13-year-old boy, and this is what the rabbi says. He says, "So what have you learned this year, my son?" And the little boy, he's 13, looks at the rabbi, then looks at his parents, and then looks out to the congregation. And this was the most profound statement I have ever heard. In fact, I've written graduation speeches based on it. And what he said to the congregation was, "I learned that doing right is hard." Mm-hmm. Think about that, Harvey. You could hear like this sucking sound in the room when he said it, because we always tell our kids, you know, do the right thing, do this, but we're not honest with them. You know, what is it to be right? And doing right is hard. It is. And you're seeing that with all the presidential candidates. They don't have the capacity to do what's right. You know, and that is what is so shocking. So as I was listening this morning, I kept going back to that bar mitzvah going, oh my God, we should have all been bar mitzvahed. And on that note, we have Harvey Kronberg. We have Harvey Kronberg. He's the publisher of the Quorum Report. Scott Braddock is on some airplane coming somewhere to go somewhere. I'm not quite sure. But thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I really appreciate it, Harvey.
Always my pleasure, Ernie.
So there's so much to talk about. I sort of sent you a whole bunch of things. And there are two real stories. I mean, I think the most important story in some ways coming out of the last couple of weeks out of Texas is what's happening to Ken Paxton and the impeachment. And I looked at two pieces. One was from the Texas Monthly, and it said Paxton's impeachment is not a referendum on Trump. Texas Republicans have been engaged in a cold war with one another for much of the 2023 session. The impeachment vote simply caused it to heat up. That was the Texas Monthly article. But then this is the one that probably touches you because you sort of follow what's going on in Houston. And this is from the Houston Chronicle. Ken Paxton defense lawyer Tony Busby blasts baloney impeachment, predicts long Senate trial. Busby's involvement sets the stage for a trial that pits him against star lawyers Dick DeGaren and Rusty Hardin in Paxton's trial. And I need to let you know that the last time we had Scott Braddock on, he talked about these defense lawyers, Dick DeGaren and Rusty Hardin, and said, you need to understand, I mean, the lawyers for the state, they are true powerhouses. So do me a favor, show me or share with me the egos of the attorneys involved in this impeachment, because I think it's going to be such theater.
Well, frankly, they are the Super Bowl of Texas attorneys. And from a spectator perspective, it is absolutely going to be fascinating to watch. I will mention that Dick DeGaren back in the 1990s defended Kay Bailey Hutchison when the Travis County prosecutor went after her. She was a state treasurer at the time, positioning to run for her United States Senate seat. And DeGaren was so effective that they got through the opening arguments. And I've never seen this before. The judge directed the jury to acquit.
After the opening arguments?
Uh-huh.
That's amazing.
He said that apparently the prosecution has no theory in its case. Just as you were remembering those memorable words from a 13-year-old, that stuck with me forever. So I was actually cross-examined by Dick DeGaren in the Tom DeLay trial, about 8 minutes, and established the little piece that I knew of the story. And he was gentle, but you could see he had the jury riveted.
So tell me about the prosecutors and the defense attorneys, because I want people to understand that this isn't a trial. This is really sort of like politics on steroids. I mean, it's going to be an unbelievable trial. And I hope they make it into a Netflix series when it's done. Describe the players and their connection to this impeachment.
Both the House and the Senate have committees that are technically the management committees, but this is such a massively high stakes game that the House established threshold when they brought in DeGaren and Hardin, who are truly legendary. And Rusty Hardin, what's her name, Nicole? Well, he's defended mostly. He's been on the defense side, but he's also been a prosecutor. He's they're both kind of old country lawyers who will slice and dice you before you even know you've been sliced and diced.
Wow.
Tony Busby and Cogdill, who are representing Paxton in this, Cogdill's been working with him for the last 8 years, essentially delaying discovery on the whistleblower case. But Busby is a somewhat bombastic, over-the-top plaintiff's lawyer with all the characteristics you might imagine. So yesterday at the press conference, he was saying this was a sham of a deal and there were no rules of evidence and all the allegations are false. And then he proceeded to talk mostly about the process of the impeachment and none of the substance of the allegations. But what he did say, and it is absolutely true, is we really don't know how this is going to work until the Senate issues its rules. Right. I've got a column that I'll be posting today, which talks about all the different ways that the lieutenant governor can put his thumb on the scale if he so chooses. But we are going to have national media totally focused on this. And we are going to have a verbal battle of titans. But I do believe that Busby was correct. I don't think they can wrap this up in a couple of weeks if they're literally going to do talk to witnesses. Busby said on the defense side, they've got 65 witnesses they've identified.
This
could well, it's Dan Patrick's worst nightmare, but it could, well, and frankly, the Republican Party's worst nightmare, because it could linger on for months. Pretty soon we'll be approaching filing. Well, pretty soon in the fall, we'll be doing filing deadlines and getting ready for the primary. And if this is hovering over as part of the narrative, along with potential Trump trials, even though they're not really related, it's it can't help but cast a large shadow on
so let me ask a question. The Texas legislature only meets once every 2 years.
Correct.
But if they're now going to be in this impeachment swamp, does that mean that the Senate needs to sit throughout the entire trial? And therefore, what would have been maybe a year off, or they may have a special session, they're now going to be consumed either with a special session or an impeachment trial. I mean, or do they get to like take a number and go, you show up this day, I'll show up tomorrow.
We're waiting to see what the rules say, but you're absolutely correct. Mixing legislative politics with judicial proceedings is a really dangerous concept, because there's politics is by definition horse trading, and the impeachment trial is essentially determining innocence or guilt, fitness for office, and they are two entirely different imperatives with two entirely different sets of rules. And I think, just intuitively, I do not know this, but I think intuitively that they cannot commingle them. Whenever the trial proceeds, it will take center stage and crowd out anything else that may be happening in Austin.
Will the entire Texas Senate have to sit for the trial?
Yeah, well, yes, except for potentially the three folks that have been compromised by previous testimony. Of course, Angela Paxton, the attorney general's wife,
right.
A fellow named Brian Hughes, who at the request of Ken Paxton submitted essentially a bogus opinion request for an opinion, which was then used to help this Austin developer avoid some foreclosures.
Right.
And then we have another senator for whom Paxton's mistress worked for several years.
Now, God, this really is a Netflix series. I'm just telling you, everyone. But well, as I'm listening to this, he said that Busby says he's going to call 65 witnesses. So I am just trying to think, are there enough hours in the day and enough weeks in the summer? I mean, it's like at the point that you're going, if they're going to be sitting through this trial for so long, not only is it exhausting, but so much of the work of Texas will be delayed. Because, I mean, how do you fit in a special session in between this? How long do you go? Do you only meet 3 days a week? Do you meet 5 days a week? Do you meet for 8 hours a day? I mean, I don't know what you've written, but I can't even imagine how you wrap your arms around this potential impeachment trial.
Well, there's obviously everything is going to be contingent on the rules, and we're not privy to what the process is for them to, as they arrive at the rules. It's not, hasn't been public or open. And the lieutenant governor certainly hasn't discussed it, but I'm presuming his son, by the way, is a, Dan Patrick's son is a, assistant, federal prosecutor down in Houston. So it's an interesting nuance that, while, Patrick is purely a political animal, he, also has family on the side of the feds in Houston. Just one of those interesting nuances.
But exactly. So let me just go back to the other article that I mentioned, because this was about the trial, but this is the article from the Texas Monthly. Paxton's impeachment is not a referendum on Trump. So explain to my audience, well, I mean, everybody was so excited to see Republicans stand up against their own. They're like, oh my God, we're turning a page. Oh my God. And then of course you hear all the presidential candidates not being able to turn the page. So give me a little bit about the background, the dynamic that's going on with the attorney general, because it really, despite the fact that Donald Trump supports Ken Paxton, despite the fact that Ted Cruz came out in support of the attorney general, virtually nobody else did. And they looked like they had egg on their face. What do you see as the defining issue here? Like they mentioned the dueling Republicans and that sort of Paxton ends up being sort of the edge walking of this conversation. Like he's the sacrificial lamb, but he really almost demanded that they address him.
Exactly. There's no virgins in Texas political process.
No virgins.
So would not presume that he is unique. Maybe the boldness of the alleged crimes, like being responsible for generating 29 fake grand jury subpoenas, might be a little over the top relative to some of the other corruption. Yes. What we have here is essentially a culmination of the battle between the traditional or slash establishment style Republicans versus the movement Republicans. The only people that are committing themselves to Paxton are not even the Republican Party of Texas, but the billionaire oil and gas guys out of West Texas that so dominate the Republican Party. They obviously, nobody is talking about the issues here. They'd rather talk about the process leading up to it. And of course, as happens in Republican politics, both sides are demonizing the other. And there's been a long-term assault on Speaker Phelan by this group of people, up to and including running TV ads against him during the legislative session his district.
Oh my God. Oh, this is brutal, you guys. They're giving each other knuckle sandwiches.
Right. And then the lieutenant governor is used to dominating the process. And Speaker Phelan apparently is not going to have any of it. So in many ways, the House impeachment vote, I think the allegations are, if you've read them, are obviously very compelling, including interfering with the federal investigation by helping out the target of the investigation. If proven to be true, may put him in jail, which is why I say that the impeachment trial is the least of his problems. If the FBI they've sat on this for a couple of years, but I'm not sure they knew all the details that have come out wow. So far. Having said all that, the personal attacks on Speaker Phelan were so over the top, and he is reasonably well regarded by both Democrats and Republicans as a fair broker in the House. Of course, you know, you can point to exceptions along the way, but as a general rule. And so when they started attacking him as Drunk Dade and California Dade, it was a very bold move to authorize the General Investigating Committee to go after, to take a serious look at Paxton. He got an enormous vote of confidence when 74% of the Republican caucus voted to impeach.
Wow. That number is mind-blowing. 74% of anything is mind-blowing. But when you realize it's one of their own, it's kind of shocking. And I guess we have the one quick question before we sort of change the topic. Mm-hmm. Who's paying for Paxton's representation?
They were explicitly inexplicit yesterday.
Oh, good. I always want to know who writes the checks.
Yes. And Tony Busby, the most vocal of the two, probably the lead attorney, cut that question short, saying there's no state funds in this. When the follow-up question, well, who's paying you? He said, we're not going there, or something to that effect, which leads all of us to presumptively think that it's the Wilkes brothers and Tim Dunn and the same people.
Will they be required to reveal that he is a public official? Is this a private contract situation, or is this something where they're going to be required to actually share where is this cash coming from? I mean, I think this is something, it reminds me of the congressman from New York who got bailed out to the tune of $500,000 and doesn't want to tell people who wrote the check. I'm just thinking, you know, George Santos and Ken Paxton have a lot in common.
And I don't think that they're going to have to disclose the funding source. Needless to say, on the House side, these two superstar attorneys who are probably, you know, $1,500 an hour attorneys are working at a deep discount. And they present kind of an obviously more reflective perspective, whereas over on the Senate side on the defense side, working for Paxton yesterday was mostly just talking to the TV cameras and not addressing any of the substance of the issues. I think we know where the money's coming from. There's plenty of trails leading there, but we can't conclusively say.
I always want to sniff out where the checks with comments are coming from. Of course, it tells you more about the politics than anything else. So I'm looking at this article, and this was the year that Governor Abbott really wanted to push the voucher concept, and he was unsuccessful. And that's one of the reasons why I suspect that he's going to do something in a special session. I don't know if it's just going to be about property taxes or vouchers or whatever. But I was looking at an article at the Texas Monthly, and it was rural school districts are facing financial ruin. Some state officials prefer it that way. And then they give a really interesting quote. The conservative gun-toting superintendent of Fort Davis Independent School District is fed up. And I won't use the bad word he uses, but he says, I'm not patient enough to spend times with a-holes in Austin, and I'm not rich enough to buy any votes. The challenge of equity in public education is universal. It's true across all 50 states, trust me. If you are a poor rural district, you're not going to see the kind of revenue you need to really provide the kind of educational outcomes you know you want for your students. But what is the challenge here? Because, you know, one of the rationales is that, you know, the governor wanted vouchers, but who is the biggest pushback against vouchers? Were, guess what? Rural school districts. They don't believe in it. So in a lot of ways, if you want to see them die on the vine, part of the reason is that you're not supportive of the governor's agenda.
The irony here is that 48% of the Republican vote in the last election came from rural Texas. Yeah. Republicans would not be in charge in Texas were it not for the rural vote. And yet, piece by piece, they're decimating rural Texas to the tune of we didn't take the Medicaid expansion dollars, which meant rural hospitals were closing. That's actually a really central issue out when your nearest hospital is 150 miles away and that one closes. And then the next nearest hospital is 300 miles away. We're a big state. The Texas Monthly story really captured the public school finances really arcane. And just to give you one example, the way we pay per student today is, they call it butts in seats. How many butts students are seat. Actually okay. there, as opposed to how many students are enrolled. So in urban areas where you might have a high absenteeism, you're punished for the high absenteeism because you don't have as many seats and butts and seats as you need. There's all these very arcane formulas that interact with each other, and it really does. We've got law firms that specialize just in that, obviously. I think the rural school districts see the erosion of their per pupil dollars, but deciphering the formulas, as was captured in that story, makes it very difficult for them to participate. And don't forget, we've had this long movement now to try and prevent taxpayer dollars from being used for lobbying. Well, mm-hmm. if you've got a 400 student school district out in West Texas, you have no capacity to speak to the legislature. You have to join with other rural school districts, pool your money, and be able to hire some professionals to navigate the process. But not only are they slowly, whether intentionally or not, strangling rural Texas, they are also, there's an effort to essentially silence them by preventing the use of taxpayer dollars for lobbying.
So let me go back to your antiquated way of funding. And you mentioned butts in seats. Wow. Mm-hmm. So that means that if you're physically absent, you don't get the dollars for that day. But mm-hmm. if you're physically there, you do. What the H happened during COVID? How do you track a butt and how do you track a seat in the middle of a pandemic? And how do you hurt school districts? Because, you know, in certain areas, there might be greater spread than in others. Could you keep your school open? Could you keep your school shut? I can't even imagine how the formula worked during the pandemic, because it seems to be like such a challenge. And then I guess the other follow-up question is if you have this thing called butts in seats, do you have people that they just hire to round up kids to make sure that they show up for school? No, I'm serious. You know, it's kind of like, it's like if every student that doesn't show up, you lose X number of dollars, it pays to have someone that literally knocks on doors and says, here, get in the back seat. I'm taking you to school, because it just is so vital to keep the rest of the school financially sustained.
Well, and through the course of a year, for instance, you'll probably, in Austin Independent School District, you'll have erosion of student population as people move out to Round Rock and Georgetown, San Marcos. One session, they actually did incorporate truancy officers for urban areas. I'm not sure if that's still happening or not, but as we both know, they continue to dump mandates both on local governments and school districts without providing sufficient funding to meet the additional mandates. So, it's a slow strangulation. And frankly, at the moment, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Patrick and the voucher supporters are doing their damnedest to undermine public education in order to make their case.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, we're beginning to realize that really what vouchers are about is about going back to segregation. There was a really interesting quote. Milwaukee, Wisconsin is the oldest voucher program in America. They did it in the 1980s, okay? And I was reading an article. I told this to my audience yesterday. I was reading an article, and the rationale for the vouchers in the 1980s was that Milwaukee had these poor Black kids that were stuck in these bad urban schools, and vouchers was a way to get that Black kid a really good education and get them out of Milwaukee. And they said, fast forward to 2023. Now what is the voucher for? The voucher is for the white kid, so the white kid can get away from the Black kid.
Let's just remember one quick observation. Vouchers was originally conceived by, Milton Friedman, for one, because he won a competition, but the liberal Brookings Institute, the progressive Brookings Institute, actually was the first one to start formalizing how you could do vouchers and charter schools. And Polly Williams, the first Black state rep, actually came down to Texas in the 1990s advocating with just that frame, that this was a way to reach underserved students.
Right.
And very powerful, very persuasive, and pretty dramatic to have Holly Williams down here.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. If it is Friday, it must be the Quorum Report. It's either Scott Braddock, who's now on a plane, or the boss, Harvey Kronberg, who is the publisher of the Quorum Report. Thank you so much for doing this, Harvey. Butts in seats. I'll never forget that one. That's a really interesting thing. Anyway, we will talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Artie Artist and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute.
Trump was finally indicted yesterday. I am one of those people who wanted the Justice Department and President Biden to move more quickly here and was disappointed when months went by and there were no indictments. However, it is clear now that Attorney General Merrick Garland and Special Counsel Jack Smith did their homework, and they did it very thoroughly. The charges against Trump are not only very grave ones under the Espionage Act, including destruction or falsification of records, obstruction of justice, lying in some capacity, but the evidence of his guilt is overwhelming. Now, there has to be a trial. That is how the system works. But if you sit here now, at the very least, the most pro-Trump position you could take is that, well, there certainly is some evidence here that suggests there should be a trial. The most realistic evidence position you could take is that it's pretty clear he's guilty. This is an important moment, not because of how it will affect the Republican primary, it will help Trump in the Republican primary, because this is one of those moments where for the next, 48 hours, there is still time for some Republicans to come out on the side of America rather than on the side of Donald Trump. But those that don't will have redoubled their commitment to their cult leader and the fascist movement he represents. And the more people who take that position, the more the future of the United States, American democracy, but also the United States as a functioning, unified state, is in peril.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute. Or subscribe.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
On Thursday morning. So much is happening on Thursday morning. Pat Robertson dies at the age of 93. I just told you my Pat Robertson story from little tiny town of Orford, New Hampshire. We know that they're shutting down airports. They're not playing baseball in New York because of the incredible smoke and fires and everything else from Canada that have swept down. And really, at one point, they said that New York is the epicenter of the worst air quality in the world. And I thought, well, I've got to touch on that one as well. But before we get into any of those things, let me introduce our guests. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician. He's been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut and was an advisor to Bill Clinton. Welcome to the program, Mr. Curry.
Great to be with you, as always.
Harold Meyerson is the editor-at-large at the American Prospect and was an opinion columnist for the Washington Post from 2003 until 2015. He served as the executive editor of the LA Weekly from 1989 through 2001. Thank you so much for joining us, Harold.
Always a pleasure.
So I'm going through my Twitter feed, and Walter Shapiro from New Republic follows me, and I follow Walter, and we've hung out with each other every 4 years for, I think, three decades, okay? Because he covers presidential politics, and so do I. I didn't smile, but I did. Walter Shapiro's tweet was as follows. I am planning to go to New Delhi for the weekend for the air quality. And as I thought, well, that's a cheeky thing to say. What I wanted to share with you is my personal air quality story. My husband dies in 2013, you guys. And my daughter, who lives in Shanghai, says, Mom, I'm getting you a ticket. I want you to get away from the States, Rola. I want you to come visit me. You've never been to China. Just come. So it's December of 2013. So I fly to Shanghai. Now, here's the kicker. It took us almost 29 hours to get from New York to Shanghai. Now, how is that possible? Well, let me tell you, part of the reason why it took us so long was that they could not land the plane in Shanghai because of an inversion, and the air quality was so bad that they actually had to go to Beijing, that usually has the worst air quality in the world, in order to land the plane. And then we had to wait there 6 or 7 hours on the tarmac until the air quality improved so we could then fly to Shanghai. And I'm thinking, wow, air quality so bad, they can't even fly planes. And then I'm hearing that they shut the airport at LaGuardia. Okay, so I want people to understand the consequences of these stories. And then last but not least, so I finally get to Shanghai, I get to my daughter's apartment, and she has 4 or 5 different masks on her wall. And I said, why do you have different kinds of masks? And she says, it depends on the level of pollution, Mom. So when it's really bad, I use this 3M one. When it's not so bad, I use this one. And I went, oh my God, how do you live like this? So having said that, Mr. Curry, I guess New York is going to begin to figure out how to live like this. And this is not going to be a one-off, because we're at the early stages of the fire season in Canada. We're not actually in the midst of the real fire stage. And now we're beginning to realize the consequences of the climate crisis. It doesn't recognize borders, rivers, mountains, air. It just sort of shows up. And if it's this bad now, how do you economically and physically and socially and medically plan for this kind of thing? Because it is frightening people in ways I think they had no understanding of. They should have just been with me in 2013 in Shanghai.
In the late 1990s, I spent a fair amount of time debating people from various conservative think tanks about climate change.
Right.
And I'd been working on it for some time. And it was always hard then, because we were still arguing from computer models. And it's easy to rebut a computer model. Garbage in, garbage out. What do you know? My town feels just like it did when I was growing up. As time went on, of course, there was more and more anecdotal evidence, and then simply a flood tide of horrible news about rising and warming oceans and droughts and tsunamis. And we are now living in day-to-day contact with the foreshadowings, just the foreshadowings,
right,
of what the real effect of climate change will be. And it's still hard to convince people. It's still hard to talk to people who walked out in the morning, and experience this and explain to them what the connections are and what needs to be done. And our party still doesn't make the case. Climate change ought to be central to the message and policy of this party. And the good news is, if there is any, that the weather has done so much better a job of political education than the Democratic Party has. People have basically learned not from their leaders, but from the weather. And the public is all set now to annihilate the arguments of the petrochemical crowd and the Republicans who serve them and some Democrats who serve them.
Bob Henley, who writes for WorkBites.com, Salon.com, Insider NJ, has an interesting article at InsiderNewJersey.com. And yet, at his tweet, he writes, where's the POTUS White House address using the toxic cloud that envelops North America as the teachable moment that illustrates we can no longer accept half measures to fight the climate crisis. That's exactly what Bill just said. And Harold, that's exactly the problem. We're getting butt kiss, okay? So here we know, he'll show up and all the horrific tragedies in mass shootings and all the horrific tragedies in so many ways that we've seen around the globe as well as in the United States. And you usually see something coming out of the Biden administration. This story of what's going on in New York is cataclysmic. It is cataclysmic. People are going to die from this, okay? You know, you can't work outside on an infrastructure project, Joe Biden, because you can't breathe the air. And I really do wonder, where are they on this? Are they so afraid of making the connection because the Republicans are still going to make up the fiction that there is no climate crisis? Oh, it's just a fire in Canada. It's a one-off, when you and I both know that's just not the case.
This touches on something I've been writing about lately, which was partly inspired by Joe Biden's first Oval Office address at 7 p.m. on a Friday evening when nobody is watching anything, about the debt ceiling deal. And that is that it is not in his wheelhouse to really connect with people that way. And I don't think this is a function of his age. This has never been his forte. I mean, my analysis was that, his predecessor as a Democrat, a Democratic president, Barack Obama, made brilliant, morally compelling, eloquent speeches and didn't really, except for the big exception of Obamacare, for which we basically have Nancy Pelosi to thank, really work the levers in Congress to get stuff done. Whereas Biden is the polar opposite. He can work some of the levers in Congress, but, to save his life, he can't make an eloquent, morally compelling speech on climate change or much else. I mean, that's just not who he is. Yeah, you can be a fairly good president when it's not a time of crisis.
Right.
With that skill set, but in, with New York turning, different shades of brown, that's a crisis. I'm not sure that this is something that he is up to.
Bill, I go back to the article that The Nation magazine asked me to write about whether Joe Biden should run for president, okay? This is back a couple of months ago. And here's how I entitled it: Urgency of the Moment. Okay, the word is urgency. And I think that, Harold is absolutely right. He has this, this press availability, or he gives a speech from the Oval Office. And you're right, it's on a Friday night at 7 o'clock. It's about the debt ceiling. And I hate to break it to you, unless you actually lived the consequences of the debt ceiling, it doesn't touch you in any way, shape, or form. It didn't improve your income. It didn't get your kids to a doctor when they were sick. It didn't fix your roof. It didn't make the cost of eggs cheaper. None of those things happened. And so he's taking credit for something that, really is in the atmosphere, but doesn't necessarily generate anything. And then, as Bob Pennelly said, here we have people who literally cannot leave their house, planes cannot land, and where is POTUS? But he should be basically on the balcony at the White House outside going, I can breathe here, they can't breathe there. Why and what does this tell us? But instead, there's nothing. And I just feel like we are constantly losing these opportunities to connect. And is it just that it's Joe Biden's personality? Or frankly, is it the persona of the Democratic Party? The Republican Party takes credit for every piece of crap that happens. They take credit when they point to the finger when everything bad happens. And the Democrats, they don't know how to message. And clearly, Biden, of all of them, is probably the weakest at messaging.
As Harold points out, he always has been, and it's only going to get worse from here. Yeah, I was listening to your governor, Chris Sununu, bow out of the Republican race the other day. Every so often, he has had some quip or observation that has caught my eye that I've actually enjoyed over the last year or so. And then I watched his complete moral abandonment of this race. He's not even running, and he still won't say that Trump has to go. Mm-hmm. He still says that Trump is a problem. Not for the democracy, not for the country, but only for his party, because he might not win, which they pretty much all do. On the Democratic side, we're very different. Our problems are very different, but it's sort of the same for very different reasons. We have a front runner who is the incumbent who should not be renominated, in my opinion. It's too great a risk to the country. And our party is at a time when, like the Republican Party, we need to change our basic approach to governance. We are in dire need of a reconfiguration of both policy and message. And Biden, people who don't talk clearly usually don't think clearly either. And Biden is an example of that. And he's an example of a lifetime in politics in which you are constantly paid not to examine things too closely by your exactly. major donors. It's dangerous. I used to sit next to Joe Lieberman in the state Senate, and he never quite knew a lot about the hardest bills at the very end because he knew he didn't want. And so we're at a point now where I believe, and I will do this, and I just think that we all need to do this. We have to call for a contest. I know there's not a Vietnam War that divides the party. I know that that Biden's policies have been good. I don't give them as much applause as others do, but many of them have been helpful. I know we don't have a charismatic challenger to lead the field, but right now, RFK, who's
can do real damage
out of his mind, is doing almost as well as Ron DeSantis in the polls. Yep. This suggests to me that there's a massive market out there for a primary that, by the way, would probably be fairly civil. It wouldn't be a grudge match. It wouldn't be a deep civil war within the party. If we could find an articulate progressive who knew how to make a case to the middle class.
Well, Newsom's doing a pretty interesting job. Let me just say it. Yeah, you have your problems with Newsom.
We've talked to a few. There's some pretty good ones out there. I'll just stop there. But this is a moment of urgency, just as you said. And I think we have to start saying it out loud. It's not too late. It's almost too late, but it's not too late.
So I want to go back to something that Harold did. So Harold, you wrote that piece about, you know, Joe Biden's deciding to hold this speech on a Friday night at 7 o'clock to talk about the debt ceiling. Yawn. Oh my God. It made no connection. Didn't do a blip in the polls. Nobody understood. But let me just say that I'm actually going to take that back, because then I go to the other article by David Dayan, the oncoming train wreck of restarting student loan payments. There are people that will feel what happened with that debt ceiling arrangement. Yep. And it's the people that Joe Biden needs. It's the people that he has to get their vote. And who is suddenly going to find in the fall, or what is it, September, when all of a sudden they're going to have to start repaying their loans of $300, of $400, of $500 a month, when they can't find housing that will actually accommodate them, and they can't afford to buy a car. They still see the cost of food being somewhat inflated. And now they're going to suddenly, you know, look at this new bill they have to pay. And it's coming right on the heels of when they're going to be asked to vote for this party. So who did he throw under the bus? But the very group of people he absolutely needs. He can talk about the fact that, you know, I'm working really hard to make sure that this doesn't impact you, and I'm trying to get $10,000 off your student loan. Well, number one, that hasn't happened. And number two, they're going to have to start repaying. So guess what? They feel the pain. They don't see the promise.
It's a real problem. And what Bill just said, for the first time, one particular light bulb went on in my head, which is to say, where is our Allard Lowenstein? Allard Lowenstein, some point, I think probably late 66 or early 67, said someone's got to run against Lyndon Johnson. Right. And it took him months to get anyone. He kept trying with Robert Kennedy Sr. now, not Jr. Kennedy kept saying, no. And finally, Gene McCarthy said yes. And did better than anyone thought he would in your own state of New Hampshire, Arnie. You know, and then Bobby Kennedy got in and all of that. So we don't have an Allard Lowenstein right now. We need an Allard Lowenstein right now. And that occurs to me that I'd have to write that.
That's why you do this radio show. We give you material. Come on.
Yeah, that's what Bill's comment prompted. You know, that someone needs to make the effort, and in a visible way, some figure who's around the Democratic Party. And
on top of that, not only are you concerned about RFK Jr., and I am, and I want to remind my audience here that although the New Hampshire primary is not first for Democrats, it is first for Republicans. Okay. So they're still doing the Iowa thing. And so this looks traditional to 98.9% of the American people. They have no clue what South Carolina looks like. They have no clue that the Democrats have actually changed their contest to South Carolina. But on top of that, Bill Curry in New Hampshire, anyone who is an undeclared can pick up a Republican primary ballot or a Democratic primary ballot. And what is now happening with RFK Jr. is that he is now being courted by the crazies, the libertarians, the MAGAs, the free staters. He's going to address them at their pork fest. He's now saying stuff that, I mean, if he was bad before on the whole issue of COVID and vaccines, he's getting more crazy about the border. He's getting more crazy about even the election he's raising questions about that sound like Republicans. So he really has like sort of stepped off into the abyss. But what scares me is that with no Joe Biden on the ticket in that first of the nation presidential primary, because they won't recognize this, you will have a choice between Marianne Williamson and RFK Jr. And all those crazies, if they want to do damage, they're not going to vote in a Republican primary. They're going to vote in the Democratic primary. And all of a sudden, RFK Jr. is going to look so much stronger than he is. And it's illusion. It's damaging. And in the end, the only people to blame is the DNC and Joe Biden for making a mistake because they didn't play it out politically.
I hope that any Democrat thinking of supporting RFK has caught some of his interviews with the likes of Laura Ingraham and Elon Musk.
Oh my God.
To whom he panders incessantly. I didn't really know him, but I was around him and saw him live in his younger adulthood. And I was always very impressed by him and hoped he would run for office. And he seemed to have some of his father's passion and idealism for certain, and even some of his eloquence. And what's happened to him over the course of a lifetime is just awful. This campaign is shameful, shameful. It doesn't get around our problem, which is to get someone into this race. And that, as I've said before here, the Democratic establishment's chief genius is for self-perpetuation. And they do this through a variety of
gimmicks. You're absolutely right.
The Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Clyburn passing on to Jeffries and Aguilar and Clark their leadership, Biden being the successor, Biden who's older than Clinton. It's not just the baby boomers. Violence from the silent generation. Just so we're clear, and fine, you know, it's okay. He's just not the guy. We don't have a Gene McCarthy Vietnam situation. We don't have a Ted Kennedy celebrity situation here for a challenge. We don't have a president who's done terribly, even by progressive lights.
Yes.
We do have a crisis. We have an absolute crisis. The next 18 months aren't going to be any kinder to Joe Biden than the last 18. And when you consider at least the possibility that I've been right all along, that Trump will end up his life in prison and not as the 2024 Republican nominee. When you picture that, when you picture Biden on a stage with any of their leading contenders, immediately are paralyzed with anxiety. You really let it, when you really internalize it. So we have to start this discussion. If I can say one other sentence, that just that person will also have to do some of the groundwork. Whoever that candidate should be has to be someone who can talk to both factions of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party needs to get bipartisan with itself.
Right.
And progressives have to realize that while we don't want to be a part of the Washington search for the center, which has crippled the country, we have to be part of the creation of a new center. There's some intellectual work to be done in this party that the challenger will have to undertake, that the party's establishment has simply completely defaulted on.
I want to talk a little bit about an article at The Hill, Harold. California and Texas make legal moves against Florida migrant flights. Florida officials are facing potential legal peril over GOP Governor Ron DeSantis's migrant relocation moves. California Attorney General Rob Bonta and Bexar County Sheriff Javier Salazar, whose jurisdiction encompasses San Antonio, are focusing their criminal and civil investigations on whether migrants were lured onto flights under false pretenses. So I want to talk about kidnapping. All right. You know, I mean, because that's really what this is. And I'm not sure, do you have to be a citizen and in order to be kidnapped? Or can you be an undocumented immigrant and still be protected by the law because someone kidnapped you? I'm just kind of curious. Is there a legal version of kidnapping and a migrant version of kidnapping? But that's exactly what they're doing. They're kidnapping these people because they don't actually value their humanity. They're pawns in this game. The fact that you're seeing both Texas and California pushing back, I'm just trying to figure out, how do I package that for the Hispanic vote? Because this is really about how you are seen. You are seen as not human.
Well, you know, I mean, if in the question of is there legal kidnapping, I would say the Trump policy of separating little kids from their parents at the border actually, I think, really does fall under that category. In this case, DeSantis people say, well, they all wanted to get on the plane because they thought they were good jobs. Well, of course, no one on the receiving end knew they were coming. So that kind of...
Where's the job application?
The fraudulence of that. One sort of correction on what you said, Arnie. It wasn't Texas. It was one of the cities of Texas.
Oh, and sorry. Sorry.
As we know,
the headline was inaccurate. It was San Antonio's sheriff. You're right.
Right. And, you know, Texas is in the throes of the state preempting the cities from doing anything. They've just passed a new law which forbids cities in Texas from establishing any regulation that is stronger than the state's. You know, so anything about housing or, you know, work, just about anything, environment, you know, it essentially negates the whole raison d'etre for local government, because you can't obviously do less. You can't not, you know, in the desire to do absolutely nothing, you're violating whatever the state has, which in Texas isn't much. And, you know, if you do anything, if you want to do anything more than the state, you can't do that either. So anyway, so whatever San Antonio does, the Ron DeSantis's of Texas and the Greg Abbott's of Texas,
right,
and the now impeached attorney general of Texas, Mr. Paxton, say we don't care. And it's against the law to do anything other than what we say.
I can't believe I'm going to end with this, but it is. I don't golf. I don't even know what a golf ball looks like. But the story about the PGA and the Saudis, honest to God, Bill, I just want to take a freaking shower. I just, the whole thing is so disgusting. And like everything has a price. There is no moral authority. If they can buy this, what can't they buy? They can buy absolutely everything. And everyone now knows. You can say one thing about the integrity of this or what happened about the Khashoggi and whatever. And then 48 hours later, oh, look at how big that check is. And look at the investment. I mean, I know Harold, Bill, but Les, either one of you, just.
Well, I just want to say this is the precise analogy to the establishment Republicans and MAGA and Trump. The PGA, its yes. members have always been the most Republican wing of professional sports in America, and now they've gone over to the dark side. It's really the story of pre-Trump Republicans saying, "Okay, we're down with you. We're okay with Trump." Only in this case, it's MBS. So
yeah. And Biden could have said something, except he was just over in Riyadh, kissing rather fist bumping. The prince. And also, by the way, it's like every budget I've seen passed in America, done totally in the dark and announced to the public only when all the fell deeds have been committed and it seems too late to change it. If word of this had ever leaked, it never would have happened.
You're right.
Because
you're
public right. opprobrium would have deterred them.
And thank you for mentioning that Joe Biden can't say a word. He can't say a word.
The question for me is whether if you four putt on a hole, if you'll be dismembered.
On that note, it is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We've been talking with Bill Curry and Harold Myers. Thank you so much for that ending topic. Anyway, we will schmooze on Monday, everyone. Ciao. You change.